Pantas-tukoti-shatavatsara-samragamyo vayo-ratapi-manaso-munipun-gavanam Sopyasti-yatra-parasim-yavachintya-tatve Govindamari-purusham-tamaham-vajami. Translation: I worship Govinda, the primeval Lord, only the tip of the toe of whose feet is approached by the yogis, who aspire after the transcendental and betake themselves to pranayama by drilling the respiration, or by the jnanis who try to find out the non-differentiated Brahman by the process of elimination of the mundane extending over thousands of millions of years. There are a handful of verses in the Brahma Samhita which Prabhupada would quote from. And this is one of them. Often when he was talking about yogis and rishis and jnanis, he would quote this verse, Munipungavanam, Manaso Munipungavanam, or the first two lines, Pantas Tukoti Shatavatsara Sambragamya. It says that Pantas Koti Shata, Shata means thousands, like, and Koti means millions, so thousands and millions of years. On the path, Pantas, the yogis, they can approach practically the tips of the toes of Krishna. So the tips of Krishna's toes are, of course, covered with beautiful ruby-red toenails, and they're emitting in a beautiful effulgence, which is shimmering and soft and soothing as the glow of the full moon rays, and then multiplied times millions of times. And then it emanates and mixes with the beautiful bodily effulgence of the Lord, which is known as the Brahma Jyoti, and then expands throughout creation as the Brahman effulgence. So at best, the jnanis and the yogis that are mentioned in this verse, after millions and millions of years, they can approach the Brahman effulgence. So this verse, the theme of this verse is that Krishna is rarely achieved. Very rare to achieve him. So read the purport. Page 57, verse 34. The attainment of the lotus feet of Govinda consists in the realization of unalloyed devotion. The Kaivalya realized non-alternative state, in other words, oneness with God, which is attained by the Ashtanga yogis by practicing trance for thousands of millions of years, and by the state of merging into the non-differentiated impersonality of God and beyond the range of limitation attained by the non-dualists after a similar period passed, in distinguishing between the spiritual and the non-spiritual, and eliminating things of this limited sphere one after another by the formula of not this, not this, or not that, are simply the outskirts of the lotus feet of Krishna, and not the lotus feet of themselves. So, doesn't sound like a very encouraging verse or statement for people that follow yoga. Yoga, many people do what they call yoga, but it's really gymnastics. They just stretch their body in this way and that way, and there's many hundreds of books on yoga in the market, but real yoga, which is realizing God, is hardly practiced at all. But even if one was to practice such yoga, it takes thousands and millions of years. The proof of that is, in the history of the planet itself and the universe itself goes through different ages. Yugas, we call yugas or ages, Satyuga, Tretyuga, Dwapara, and Kaliyuga. So in Satyuga, people live a long time. Just like you read in the Bible, if you've ever had a chance to read the Bible, in the Old Testament and New Testament, they talk about personalities that lived a long time. Methuselah and Moses, they lived 750 years, 960 years. They lived a long time. And it was a long time ago, several thousand years ago, that they lived. So they lived at the juncture of Dwapara Yuga and Kali Yuga, or you can say the very beginnings of Kali Yuga, which of course still reflects a little bit of the rays of the qualities of Dwapara Yuga. So in that age, these saintly persons, Moses and Methuselah, they lived a long time. Because in Dwapara Yuga, people used to live to be 1,000 years. That was a standard lifespan. Just like in this age, a standard lifespan is 100. But if somebody's like 100 years or over, people like line up by the hundreds to come just look at him. Oh, he's 100. Wow, he's 100. You know, it's somehow or other, age is somehow equated with self-realization or spiritual realization. That's quite contrary to the reality that we see depicted in the Srimad Bhagavatam and the various itihasas. They prove that self-realization has nothing to do with age at all, of the body. You see, you ever heard of Dhruva Maharaj? How old was he? Is he 105 or 129 or 134? How old was he?
5 years
old. Like you have some children, right? 5, 4. Maybe they're not Dhruva Maharaj, but they're little boys. Maybe they are. And then there's another little boy. Who was that other little boy? He had a friend who was a half a lion. Balad Maharaj. He's another Komara. Komarat Acharat Pragyo. He says, Komarat Acharat Pragyo. He was telling his little buddies, he says, hey, look kids, let's stop playing, you know, on our computers and do Bhagavad Dharma. Komarat Acharat Pragyo. Don't you have any pragyan? Don't you have any good knowledge? Krishna Kumar means 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So they were 5 years old. So Prahlad was 5 years old and he had Darshan of Krishna's avatar, the Sring avatar. So this proves, and other examples are there, that even young children can realize God. Or the Yajnapatnis of Mathura, they had realization of God. They were just young ladies. They were maybe 25, 26 years old. They weren't 150 or anything. Like Deora Baba, used to live across Yamuna. Oh, Rukmini, Dev Rukmini was 16. Rukmini was a princess in South India. Vidarbha province in South India. She was only 16 years old, and she heard about Krishna from rishis like Narad, and she became fully attached to him, and just dreamed of him day and night, and ultimately she attained not only darshan of Krishna, but the consorthood of Krishna. Krishna became her husband. So that certainly means realizing God, have an intimate Madhurya Ras with Krishna. So she was only 16 years old. So age doesn't have much to do with it. So in the previous ages, like Satya Yuga, because that's why this verse talks about Pantastukoti Shatavatsara Sambhargamyo, that yogis and jnanis, they can follow the panta, the yoga pant, or the path of jnan, jnan pant, or the path of jnan, and yoga for millions and millions of years, and still not attain even the Brahman effulgence of Lord Krishna. So in Satya Yuga, people live to be 100,000 years. So you live one Satya Yuga and you practice yoga for 100,000 years, and another Satya Yuga, another Satya, and over and over and over, and pass through so many time periods, and finally you don't even make it. So it's kind of farcical and amusing to see people in the age of Kali drilling the respiration, as Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, drilling the respiration. And that's a fact. They do pranayama. It's part of yoga is to pranayama. I mean, that's the ultimate point, is that the asanas lead to pranayama, then you control the air, then you control the movements of the mind, and then you become the controller. You know, you become a yogi when you control the mind and senses. Until you've mastered the mind and senses, you're not a yogi, but you're a bogey. You're a bogey. So you may be, you know, wearing your leotards and your, you know, yoga suit and stuff and going, doing your yoga, but until you've mastered the mind and the senses, you're a bogey, practicing gymnastics in the name of yoga. But at any rate, so they practice, and then in the process of pranayama, they're drilling the respiration. There's so many different breaths where you breathe very fast through the nose, and anyway, I don't have to give you a demonstration, but there's various, and it really looks kind of like, you know, it looks kind of ridiculous in a lot of ways. Of course, some practitioners of Bhakti Yoga look a little ridiculous, too. You know, shaking your head 3,000 miles an hour and, you know, vibrating like, you know, with more voltage than, you know, 440 volts at the train station, you know, like a electric conduit, you know, zzz, you know, it's like, you know, sparks are coming out of his ears or something. It's not really what it's all about in terms of meditating in a fixed way with controlled mind. But obviously the person has difficulty controlling the mind, so they're trying to throw it around the universe and somehow get control of it. But so this is a little bit about, so the yogis, that, you know, that's not the way to go. The way to go is really to still the mind and senses and to breathe very deeply and very slowly and fix the mind on the nam and guna, rupam and lila of Krishna to such a point that one becomes into samadhi. So let's see, where are we? Oh yeah, I can read a second translation of that sentence. The oneness with God, which is attained by the Ashtanga yogis, after billions of years of meditation, and the state of merging into the Brahman effulgence that the great monist sages, or the impersonalists, finally attain after sitting for a similar period of time, in other words, millions of years, and by rejecting the mayic elements one by one by saying neti neti. Happiness of jnana and yoga are like water in the hoofprint of a calf, compared to the ocean of bliss tasted in pure devotional service. The practice of jnana and yoga, they make the heart becomes very hard, and it also thickens the ego. Nice phrase. The process of jnana and yoga, it makes the heart hard and the ego thick. You know, thick? Thick-headed. Stubborn. Proud. They think, I know so much. I'm a big yogi. Where is their Trinada Pisuni Chena? So one point I just was thinking about this morning when I was kind of going over these notes, and I wanted to add some things to this, which I did. Discussion is that when we read this verse about jnana and karma, we might think, yeah, it's just bhakti, and of course we may not even be very educated what is bhakti tattva or how to practice properly. But at any rate, so when we hear a term like jnana in this verse, we may say, yes, jnana is not required, I don't need jnana. But in the Nectar Devotion, it defines pure devotional service by a very important verse in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. Actually, when Rupa Goswami begins the discussion of Uttama Bhakti, what is pure bhakti, which is the goal of our lives, what is pure bhakti? Krishna Prema, you can, well, not really, I mean, at least to Krishna Prema, but Uttama Bhakti, then he mentions this verse. Anyabhilashita shunyam jnana karma dhyanavritam anukulyena krishnanu shilanam bhakti uttama. So uttama bhakti, what is uttama bhakti? So first he defines uttama bhakti, and then he explains the other types of bhakti. So there he says anyabhilashita shunyam jnana karma dhyanavritam. So this phrase jnana karma dhyanavritam, this is actually the what's talking about in this verse number 34 by Lord Brahma in Brahma Samhita. He's saying that it's not by jnana or by yoga, or which includes, you know, karma, the practices or actions of yoga, you'll not attain the absolute truth. It's not possible. But then Vishnu Chakravartipad, he has his commentary on Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, which is also available in English. It's in the market, you can buy. It's called Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu Bindu. Which is a very often you see in our line of Vaishnavacharyas, they title their books in different ways. Sanatana Goswami who was the elder brother of Rupa Goswami, and considered his Shiksha Guru and well-wisher. He wrote a book. He analyzed the Srimad Bhagavatam and the different personalities there into two categories, explaining the qualities of different devotees, which devotee had received the most mercy of the Lord, and then which dham of the Lord, or location of the Lord, in terms of from Devidham, to Maheshdham, to Haridham, of these three dhammas which Brahma mentions briefly, which of these are the topmost region? So the book is in two parts. Many of you maybe have read that book, Brihad Bhagavatamrita. So that's by Sanatan Goswami. So he calls it Brihad Bhagavatamrita. So that's the nectar, the big nectar about the Bhagavatam, the Brihad. Brihad means big, like the Brihad Mardanga is the Sankirtan movement, and the little Mardangas you hear 200 meters away, but the Sankirtan movement shakes the whole world and reverberates through the whole universe. Even the demigods come down to hear the results of the Sankirtan marathon. And they take part in the Sankirtan to observe it. So, and that, so that's Brihad Bhagavatamrita. Then sometime later, Rupa Goswami analyzed the Srimad Bhagavatam also, in particular categories of tattva, to establish how Krishna, the different expansions and swamsha expansions and different aspects of Krishna and bhakti and whatnot. So he, being in a mood of humility next to his brother Sanatan and respect, he entitled his book Laghu Bhagavatamrita. So it's also Bhagavatamrita, but it's Laghu. Laghu means the little one, the little nectar. The little book about the nectar from the Bhagavatam, but the big book about the nectar of Bhagavatam is Sanatan. So he calls it the little. Laghu means light, small, little. And Brihad means heavy, big, expansive. So in that way, in a similar way, Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu was written by Rupa Goswami. And that's the, Sindhu is the ocean of nectar. Nectarine mellows experience when one attains pure bhakti. Bhakti Ras, Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. So then 250 years later, Vishnu Chakravartipad, he studied that book and he wrote his own commentary on particular aspects, especially analyzing bhakti. And all the 64 limbs of bhakti, etc. So he called it Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu Bindu. Bindu means like, you know, Bindu means a little drop, a little dot. So his book was a drop from the ocean of nectar, but actually it's really that it seems like maybe more like a lake, more like you know, the Great Lakes of America or something, or some, you know, the Caspian Sea of or the Baltic Sea. It seems like a pretty big, or Mediterranean. It's maybe not the Pacific or Atlantic Ocean, but it certainly is a lot of nectar in there, and a very, very helpful book for anyone who wants to know more about nectar of devotion. If they study this book, they'll really illuminate themselves. We had some idea, although, again, we're really extending ourselves into unqualified regions, but we had some idea that after completing this course, which may be in December or so, after Kartik, we finished the book, November, end of November, December, I wanted to teach a course on Rasa Tattva, from Nectar Devotion. And all these different aspects. You know, the last part, the nectar devotion. I mean, kind of study it and teach it simultaneously. So that would bring in this book. So at any rate, he gives this explanation of this verse, and he says that the key point that's related to this verse 34 is jnana karmadi anavritam. Anavritam means that the cultivation of bhakti should be free from the covering of jnana and karma and so forth. So the point I started off here was that we may tend to think that jnana, that this verse is down on jnana and it's down on yoga. So we all, that sounds good. I really don't want to get all this jnana and all this knowledge, and so it's not required. We just do bhakti. We just take prasadam, like you said. We'll eat prasadam and we'll chant Hare Krishna and try to, you know, be celibate or whatever, pure, and then we'll go back to Godhead. Of course, you will. But in the practice of your eating prasadam or chanting the holy name, you may find impediments and obstacles due to improper practices or insufficient knowledge or understanding who, what, when, where, why, and how of what you're doing. And because of lack of faith and lack of inborn determination, you'll give up these so-called simple practices and not attain the rare fruit of Krishna prema, which could be relishable by one who sticks to these seemingly simple practices. Therefore, Gyan is very much a part of bhakti. And in this Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, Vishwanatha Chakravarti explains there's three kinds of Gyan. One is the kind of Gyan that's mentioned in this verse, which is opposed to bhakti and is external, and we don't really care about that. But the other two are very much favorable for bhakti, and these we care about. And basically that means, one, just to preface the reading of what I've read, is that one type of Gyan is knowledge about the identity of Krishna. I mean, who the heck is Krishna? Who is he? What's he all about? You know, Krishna Tattva, Prema Tattva, Shrishti. How did he create? How does he do pastimes? All the different aspects of Krishna. So, to understand Krishna and his identity. Then the second thing is, which is kind of obvious, the second category type of knowledge is to understand, guess what? You're not the body. You're not a man. You're not a woman. So to understand the identity of the jiva, jiva tattva, really understand, and not only understand, but realize it. Gyan and vigyan. To understand the identity of the jiva, and then a relationship with Krishna. Okay, there's God and Krishna and all about Him, and then there's me and what all I am really in reality, what I actually am eternally. Then there's the two of us. You know, there's Him and me, and there's Krishna and me. So, how do we relate? Or what do we do with each other? What's our foundation or relationship? That's called sambandha. So that's the second category of knowledge. And the third category of knowledge, which is alluded to or mentioned in this verse by Lord Brahma, is nirvishesh gyan. Nirvishesh means, you ever hear that word, nirvishesh? It's Brahma aikya, means, aikya means like oneness. So that knowledge is mentioned here. So that knowledge we don't really care about, and it's against bhakti. So we don't want that type of gyan, but we really require the other two types of gyan. So we'll just read a little bit about how Vishwanatha Chakravartipada explains them. Some technical terms, for those that like technical terms. But anyway, I just say it. The first category of knowledge that's not opposed to bhakti, but rather this is essential knowledge when we begin bhakti. It's called Tat Padhartha Gyan. Tat Pad Padhartha means this knowledge, the object of this knowledge is good. It's knowledge, what is this kind of knowledge, this first type of knowledge that we require in order to progress in bhakti properly? Knowledge of the constitutional identity of Bhagavan Sri Krishna. This knowledge includes understanding these 7 points. I kind of listed them as 7. It wasn't really listed that way, but just for the sake of making lists. We should understand that Krishna is the dot 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 number one. That Krishna is the absolute truth, the non-dual Parabrahma, the origin of all. The Sarvakarana Karanam. Sounds familiar? That Krishna is the cause of all causes. That's number one. Number two is that Krishna is a reservoir of all qualities of Aishwarya and Madhurya. In other words, he has all the qualities of majesty, regality, or royal pomp and power and omnipotence. But he has all the qualities of Madhurya, which means sweetness and intimacy. And that's one point. So the third thing is that he has no material qualities, but he's full of unlimited transcendental qualities. So he's not nirgun, as the Mayavadis say. He's nirgun, he has no qualities. Number four, Krishna is Satchit Anandamaya Vigraha. Right? Satchit Ananda. Satchit Anandamaya Vigraha. It means he's the personal form of eternality or existence, bliss, and knowledge. Number five, Krishna possesses inconceivable unlimited potencies or shaktis, achintya sarva shaktiman. In other words, Krishna is known as Shaktiman, and Radharani is known as Ladini Shakti, or so many shaktis. Parasya shaktir vividaya shruyate, sabhavaki gyana balakriya cha. And the Shvetashvatara Upanishad, it gives a definition of God. So it explains that he has unlimited energies, Parasya Shaktir, Vidaya Shuyate, Svabhaviki Gyana Bala Kriya Cha. But they can be analyzed as three, Gyan, Bala, and Kriya. Anyway, that's another discussion. But he is the Shakyamun. He is the possessor of Sarva Shakti. Means he possesses so many unlimited energies, and they're inconceivable. So in English we say Krishna or God possesses inconceivable unlimited potencies, like Jiva Shakti, Ladini Shakti, Samvit Shakti, Sandini Shakti, Srishti Shakti, so many Shaktis, Leela Shakti. Number 6, God or Krishna is both Ras and Rasika. This means that Krishna is the abode of all rasas. He's called the emporium of Ras. In the Western world, they have these different shopping malls, and they sometimes have stores that are, that say, emporium. In fact, I think the first Jagannath deity came from some emporium in San Francisco, the little one. Something, they call it something emporium, imports emporium or something. I forget the name. Emporium means it's a big store that has all kinds of junk in it. I mean, everything from everywhere and every kind of thing. So Krishna is sometimes called the emporium of all rasas. He is Rasaraj, right? We describe Chaitanya Mahaprabhu as, because he's Sri Krishna Chaitanya, Radha Krishna Nahe Anya. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is none other than Radha and Krishna. So he is Mahabhav Sarupini Radharani, and he is Rasaraj Sri Krishna Bhagavan Shamsundar. So therefore, the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Krishna's Kaviraj, describes Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu as Rasaraj Mahabhav. So this is Krishna, that he is the both Ras and Rasika. He is the abode of all rasas. In other words, he reciprocates with his devotees in Dasya Ras and Sakya Ras and Vatsalya Ras and Madhurya Ras in unlimited ways and unlimited devotees. So he's Rasaraj, the king of all rasas. And he himself is fully expert and adept in enjoying such rasas in the association with his devotees. So you see that the Srimad Bhagavatam, Nectar Devotion, other scriptures by the Goswamis, they describe the wonderful interactions that Krishna has with Subal and Sridham and Madhu Mangal and Sakya Ras and Lita Vishaka and Chandravali and Radharani and Madhurya Ras and Rohini and Kalimba and Ambika and Mukhara and of course Nanda and Yashoda and Upananda and Sunanda and Nanda and all the different fathers and mothers and elderly gopis. He has so many sweet, sweet pastimes with them in Vatsalya Ras. So he's the Rasika and the Ras. He tastes so many sweet rasas. Number 7, Krishna alone is the Sarva Avatari, the source of all avatars, and he is the Swayam Bhagavan, the original personality of Godhead, and the ultimate object to be understood by all Vedas and Shastras. So that's the first category of knowledge. It's called Tat Padartha Gyan. That Gyan, which is all about the identity of Krishna. This is required. So we can hear these different categories, or some of you are making lists of them, and we can ask ourselves, well, how much do I know about these different 7 different categories? And maybe not very much. And so that also attributes to weakness in bhakti and lack of determination to go forward. Because when you attain knowledge in these 7 different categories about Krishna, then it increases the shraddha. And it builds, it makes very strong shraddha in God. It increases our awareness of God and our faith in God and our conviction about the reality of Krishna. Now it's like, well, we sort of believe, yeah, Krishna, yeah, it sounds good. I think, I believe him. But then if we go home and meet some people of an opposing philosophy or maybe relatives, they may spin our head around in such a way that we say, well, gee, maybe it's impossible for God to be a little blue boy and you know, steal yogurt and butter and chase cows. Yeah, it is kind of fanciful. It is really, yeah, my uncle was right. That sounds pretty fanciful and it doesn't make much sense. And so we may have a very sentimental, very weak base of understanding of God. And so when you have a weak base and a very sentimental, you know, emotional, syrupy emotions, as Kundalini likes to say. He uses the word syrupy or something. And we have like a very mushy in the middle, you can say, or yes, with all these really good terms. You have a kind of a mushy understanding of Krishna Tattva, then your faith is also very mushy and like, you know, oatmeal or something. It's not like steel. And you can get swept away by a few deprogrammers or a few coarse words from your elder brother, or what to speak of running into going to Varanasi to study sitar, and your sitar teacher, you're just an innocent little bhakta from Vrindavan, and you go to Varanasi to study sitar, and your sitar teacher, he's a dyed-in-the-wool Mayavadi. And after about 5 sessions of trying to learn sitar and play ragas for Radha and Krishna, you change your colors and, you know, throw away your neck beads and throw away your beads and Hari Bo, Tattvamasi. Tattvamasi, I am that. You start identifying with the sutras of the Vedanta, and you no longer, your bhakti goes down the Ganga with the rest of the dead bodies at Varanasi. Arivo! So that's a very graphic depiction of the demise of bhakti of the neophyte. But frankly speaking, I know of examples of this. Or better yet, you go to Jayapur to see Radha Govinda, and then, but you're a little weak, and one of your friends from Europe comes to visit you, and he says, oh, why don't we visit the Vipassana Yoga Center? There's the Vipassana Yoga Center here in Jayapur, and many Europeans go there. Of course, now when I tell about it, you're all going to say, where is that? And that's what shows your nature also, right? So the Vipassana Yoga is basically an impersonal, a monist, or I don't know what it is, kind of a hodgepodge, kitschy program. But any rate, you know, from what little bit I heard about it from different people that went there sometimes, basically you go there and they clean you out of all your philosophies by, denial. What do you call it? Denial. In other words, it's silence. The main practice is that you go there and you live there, and it's all vegetarian food and everything, and a very country setting and very nice. And there's this amazing thing about it. There's no fees. You don't have to pay anything. Just at the end, but you have to. You can't leave. It's kind of like a prison or something. If you sign, you can leave, but you can never come back again. You get on the blacklist or something. But you go there, and everything, food and room, everything's free, but you have to promise to stay there for 2 weeks. And then for 2 weeks, there's total silence. 24 hours a day. And then they in the beginning, first few days, they teach all these different things about meditation. And then they show films. They show different indoctrination films to show the foolishness of different practitioners. So they show Hare Krishna's chanting and yogis, you know, doing us. They kind of really mock and blaspheme all different kind of yoga paths. At least from what I understand, people went there. And then they emphasize this yoga, you know, silence. And then at the same time, it's basically Buddhistic. It's Shunyavad. It's Buddhistic and Mayavadi. That's their basic conclusion. And they gradually indoctrinate you. They clean you out of all these things through subjecting you to like a prison, you know, concentration camp of silence. Which is, of course, good. Mon is part of all yoga systems. There's the principle of mon vrata, taking a vow of silence. And it's quite good, actually. Many gurus in the bhakti line or in other lines of yoga, you know, Sri Vaishnavas and Madhvacharyas, their gurus will tell their disciples that they should do one day a week, mon. Or one day the whole week, because they often, mostly their mantras are chanted silently. They don't chant Hare Krishna. Kirtan is not so much there. So they'll just do their studies, they'll eat, and they'll meditate on Ram or Narayan, Vishnu, etc. But no communicating in the ashram. It's that day in the ashram, total silence. It's very, very good for self-realization. So it's not that silence is bad. It's silence and meditating on your Ishtadev is good. But so what happens is, but neophytes who go to such a place, you never see them again. So we should become strong in our bhakti gyan, knowledge of Krishna. So the second type of knowledge that Vishwanath explains, it's also good for us to have, which I already mentioned, it's called Twam Padartha Gyan, which is knowledge of the constitutional identity of the jiva and his relationship with Bhagavan. Jiva tattva and sambandha tattva. This is not opposed to bhakti, but quite essential and required. So this includes jiva tattva, where did the jiva come from, why is the jiva in this world, and how does the jiva get out of this world? Are there different kinds of jivas? There's only one kind of jiva. How many kind? There's nityasiddha. Well, how many kind of nityasiddhas are there? What is a nityabuddha? All these kind of things called jiva tattva. So gurus will, shastras and gurus and Adi Lila of Chaitanya Charitamrita, some of these discussions are there about nature of the jiva. And it is, guru-shishya relationship means to learn all these different tattvas. Because they're helpful for bhakti, they're anukul, they're favorable for devotion. So I divided this into some categories, five categories, that the jivas, they are atomic particles, anu, atomic particles of living spirit or consciousness. But they are infinitesimal rays of the supreme transcendental consciousness, Sri Krishna. Pencil rays of the effulgence of Krishna's, jyoti, which is also consciousness. In the Krishna book, in one place, Prabhupada says that Krishna's Brahma Jyoti is made up of unlimited jivas. Number two, the jivas are non-different from God, yet they are eternally distinct from Him. The Chintya Beta Beta Tattva. In other words, we're simultaneously one with and different from God. We're Satchitananda Vigraha, but we're very small in quantity, and our qualities are somewhat less. Number three, the jivas are anu chaitanya. Anu means atomic. They're infinitesimal sparks of consciousness, and God is vibhu chaitanya, or big consciousness, or vast, unlimited consciousness. Number four, jivas are controlled by maya. Everyone, no one has any problem with that, right? Everyone understand that? Jivas are controlled by maya. Anyone disagrees with that? But the Supreme Lord is the controller of maya. Number five, the relationship, or the sambandha, the relationship of the jivas with Krishna is that of the eternal servant and the served. It's called Sevya and Sevaka Bhav. That's the Bhav. Sevya and Sevaka. Sevya Bhagavan is Krishna. That form of the Supreme Lord, or that Supreme Lord who receives service, is Sevya Bhagavan. And the Sevaka, sometimes it's Sevaka Bhagavan, but the servant of Bhagavan, the Sevaka, is us, is the jivas. So the relationship of the jiva with Krishna is that of the servant and the served. Sevya Sevaka Bhav. The jiva is a minute portion of the Lord, and he has a tendency to serve the Lord inherent in his nature. So inherent means it's intrinsic, it's within us, it's our nature. Just like it is the nature of a dog to bark, or the nature of sugar, it's sweet, and salt is, salty, and milk is white, and water is liquid. Different natures are there. Chili peppers, what is the nature? What is the lakshana? The surup lakshana, the intrinsic, surup lakshana means the intrinsic nature of something, the essential nature of something, swarup. The nature of its lakshana, the characteristic of its very form. So the characteristic or the lakshana of the very form of red chilies is what? No thanks. Yeah, that's what I say. I don't want any of those. No thanks. The nature is no thanks. I don't want them. If you're from North Europe, if you're from Italy or Mexico or Spain or India and all these kind of hot places, then chilies are quite all right for you. But Northern Europeans, they don't jive. They don't agree, generally. Because you didn't have them in your blood when you were in the womb of your mother. So you don't have any affinity for them. But people from Spain and Italy and, most of the world, they're warm places in the world. And they're in Indonesia, they eat chilies in the babyhood, inside the womb. So their blood is, they're made of it. So it's agreeable to them. And maybe in some cases, quite good for their health. Our Gurudev was very keen on eating green chilies every day. And using red chilies and dal, he was good for his health. So the nature, the sort of lakshan of the chilies is that they're hot, really hot. So if you don't have hot blood, from their babyhood, you can say womb days, then it's a little too hot for you. So it reacts by giving you hiccups or disturbs your vata. So that's the nature. So the nature of every jiva is service, seva. That is our nature, to serve God, but now we're covered over with all these different natures, false natures. That I am God, that I am the enjoyer, I am the controller. Hare Krishna.